Arizona health officials are working on plans for dealing with an Ebola case. The issue of quarantine has already become a contentious one.
Ebola might be the poster case for when you use quarantine. You would isolate the case and just wait out the period of time necessary to make sure they're free and clear.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Grand Canyon University wants to be a nonprofit again.
How energy efficient is Arizona?
And a Valley-based medical program goes public.
The incidence of traumatic brain injury and domestic violence victims ranges from 35% to 92%. Any scientist will tell you that those numbers stink.
Plus, a look at some of the state's political firsts and prepping for the unknown.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. And good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight. We're looking for partly cloudy skies. No threat of rain, though. Look for lows to be in the mid to upper 60s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 92. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%, and we have 91 degrees. To the Valley roadways, one accident that might give you some trouble is the 202 eastbound at the 101.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has awarded the Navajo Nation $465,000 to oversee the cleanup of nearly 60 underground storage tanks that have been leaking petroleum or other hazardous substances. The tribe will get another $320,000 to inspect tanks at 100 facilities across the reservation to ensure they meet tribal and federal standards. The owners of the tanks are responsible for making sure they're in good condition and have to pay for cleanup if they leak. The leaky storage tanks are located at several abandoned trading posts and in the Arizona communities of Tuba City, Lupton, and Chinle. The EPA says it plans to award the tribe nearly $4 million for work on storage tanks over 5 years.
A Latino voter registration group is projecting that more than 280,000 ballots will be cast by Arizona's Latino voters in next week's midterm elections. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, that estimate was released today as part of the State of Arizona's Latino Voters Report.
The report was generated by the voter registration group One Arizona. According to their analysis of election and census data, Latinos will make up about 14% or more of all votes cast this year. That's up from 12% in 2010 and 9% in 2006. Petra Falcon is the executive director of the group Promise Arizona. She says prior to the passage of anti-illegal immigration measures like SB 1070, voting rates among Latinos had been flat. However, there's been an increase since then.
It's about understanding that whoever gets elected on election day is going to be making decisions for their families. And that's what is continuing to motivate.
Falcon adds that outreach and voter registration efforts have also played a role in the growth. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Grand Canyon University, which received a lot of attention when an investment group took it over a decade ago, is ready to start an unprecedented process of moving from for-profit back to nonprofit.
For more than 50 years, Grand Canyon had been a small private college until deep debt led to the dramatic change.
Grand Canyon CEO Brian Mueller says the university is ready for another shift.
We have a solid financial footing now. And so we started to explore the possibility of restoring our not-for-profit status. We started the process about 6 months ago, and we are now at the point where we think that we'll move more aggressively in this direction. The process would take 6 to 12 months if it turns out to be successful.
Mueller says it'll be a complicated but worthwhile process.
We've frozen tuition 6 years in a row. And we want to continue to freeze tuition. We want to continue to increase our scholarship allotment so that this is being done for the benefit of the students as well as the investors. And that's where we have to find, we have to be able to satisfy both sides of that equation for us to make this work. But we would never do this if it meant students, the tuition was going to have to go up. That would be against one of the core principles that we have built this on.
With this week's developments, higher education observers are left with a lot of questions. Kevin Kinzer is chair of the Department of Education Administration at the State University of New York in Albany.
My first question is it really going to be a complete conversion to nonprofit status? There are several examples of for-profit companies that own or manage or have stakes in nonprofit universities. So my first question would be wondering whether they imagine setting up some sort of broader holding company where a nonprofit Grand Canyon University would be a subsidiary. We've seen the reverse happen, of course, with nonprofit universities setting up for-profit subsidiaries. So So there doesn't seem to be any particular reason why they wouldn't think about that as one of their options. Second thing, from a regulatory perspective, to what extent does the status, does the profit-making status of their of the institution change anything about their behavior or their activities or any of the kind of regulatory issues that have come up with for-profit institutions in other areas? They have a very distinctive operation already. I don't know of any other for-profit university that has the model that they have, being publicly traded, religiously focused, a large on-campus population in a very traditional residential environment. These are the kinds of things that you don't see in this combination in the for-profit world.
In general, do for-profit colleges and universities have an image problem?
Yes, they most certainly have an image problem. And that image problem is translated into a regulatory problem and legal problems that many of these institutions have had. And these in turn have turned into financial problems as investors have decided that the return on investment or the potential return on investment is a lot less than what they might have thought maybe 5 or 6 years ago. We've seen closures of major institutions. We've seen enormous declines in enrollment over the past 3 years. We've seen challenges to their existence even as members of the higher education community. There was just rules that were just released today from the federal government on a policy called gainful employment, which specifically targets the kinds of programs that many for-profit institutions, that all for-profit institutions have, and questions whether the education received in those programs has enough value in the labor market to be able to justify the rather high levels of tuition that are being charged. That said, Grand Canyon has been an outlier in this in terms of being able to maintain enrollment, operating, again, very distinctively in within the for-profit sphere, enjoying a reputation for those who have looked at it more closely that seems to have avoided many of the problems that other for-profit institutions such as University of Phoenix, Corinthian Colleges, ITT have established.
Does it help them in any way to compete with Arizona State or another public university if they're not for-profit? Are there some people who just won't go there because it's for-profit?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the profit status of the institution really has significant enrollment implications for Grand Canyon. In other words, they've been doing very well in building their enrollment based off of the target market that they're seeking, these religious Christian-oriented students that they want to bring into their undergraduate program, and the very convenient online programs that they've been very successful in marketing associated with them. The parallel would be to the nonprofit Liberty University, which has adopted a very similar kind of model and grown exponentially in tandem most with Grand Canyon University. So I think that from a student competition perspective, if for Grand Canyon, I don't think that the nonprofit versus for-profit status makes a difference. It does, however, take away a pretty big talking point from Arizona State and from other critics to say that it is a for-profit institution and that would be sufficient to challenge its credibility, its legitimacy within the marketplace.
Kevin Kinzer of the Department of Education at the State University of New York in Albany. Nurse Nikki Hickox of Maine went out for a bike ride today, defying the state's voluntary quarantine of medical workers who've treated patients with Ebola. That's raised a number of questions among members of the public and medical professionals. James Hodge is a professor of public law and ethics at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. James, looking at the ethics of quarantines, how are they determined? How have they changed, and are they impacted by the type of illness?
Yeah, all of those factors, Steve, they're all excellent points. You take any specific condition like Ebola and you first make an epidemiologic assessment. How are we going to stop this in its tracks? That's public health goal number one, and principles of ethics are firmly in support of that as the primary objective. From there, you have to also counterbalance various individual interests at stake. Freedoms, liberties, even if temporarily curtailed, they can present ethics issues for persons and certainly healthcare workers.
So there's a healthcare worker that is getting a lot of attention this week, the nurse from Maine, Ms. Hickox. And there's been a lot of controversy surrounding her situation. This idea that, in fact, this morning she was riding a bike, sort of flaunting things. From a general point of view, how does that look to the public to see a medical professional behaving that way? Does that affect how the general public might behave?
I think it's a very fair point. I mean, ethically, what a healthcare worker is responsible for pursuant to her licensing, her status with the state in which she practices, is held to a higher level as part of that sort of profession that she's in. To almost flaunt against what states have reasonably set as limited quarantine measures for the safety of the public's health is problematic. Ethically, she doesn't have a lot of ground to stand on when it comes down to a threat as serious as Ebola. Now, she has some medical facts in her favor, and those we can discuss further. But ethically, yeah, it is actually troubling to see a healthcare worker, I think, actually confronting state public health authorities on a threat as serious as Ebola.
When we look at ethics of a situation like this, how much of it rests in logic, and how much of it has to take into account human behavior, which isn't always logical?
It's a great point. Hey, the first principle we work with in regards to public health ethics on these issues is the principle of voluntarism. If we can get an individual to voluntarily comply with these really good, solid public health orders, we're looking to accomplish that. That's the first ethic of public health. But when it comes to potentially evading those effective, known, efficacious public health interventions like a limited quarantine, that's where you begin to ask, you know, how much do we have to do to impose upon this individual, even with certain individual freedoms that are slightly curtailed? How far can we go with that? There's a point, Steve, where you're making it quite nicely, that if you go too far, you actually take that person into the realm of potential unconstitutional infringements on her civil liberties. But if you back off too much, you end up with a specific situation that no public health authority in this country wants to see, and that is another domestic case of Ebola that could have been prevented, as occurred in Dallas.
How vital is it, even if it inconveniences someone, to err on the side of caution in a situation like this?
When you're talking about a highly infectious, fatal condition like Ebola that can be snuffed out in this country with appropriate, proper public health interventions, you're going to take these matters very seriously. That's why you're seeing such interventions being taken. Ebola might be the poster case for when you use quarantine. If you have a known case or a known exposure, you would isolate the case, you would quarantine the individual that may have been exposed, and just wait out the period of time necessary to make sure they're free and clear.
How harshly should we judge those in the case of just this nurse in Maine? Is it fair as human beings to say, hey, what's wrong with you? Or how much deeper should we look at this?
That's a neat point. And without getting into the psychology underlying what her perceptions may be, let me just make a simple and plain statement. We've got dozens of people right now in the United States under some level of quarantine. We've got military members right now that are having to adhere to some level of quarantine as pursuant to military orders. I'm not hearing from those folks any severe contentious arguments about what and how long this will infringe their civil liberties. It's a matter of sometimes having a person who perceives something as more significant, more infringing, potentially even more damaging on her personal interests than others might perceive it. In the end of the day, when you boil this down to what state and local and federal public health authorities can do, we've got the legal authority to quarantine. It will be imposed, and it will be the judgment of good public health practice, leaning on the side of preventing every possible intervention or case of Ebola in the future in the United States that will probably win out in this case in Maine and very likely other quarantine measures across the states.
James Hodge is a professor of public law and ethics at ASU's O'Connor College of Law.
Along with the other political races to be settled, Mesa residents will vote on one budget override and two bond proposals. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan takes a look at the impact all three issues could have on the owner of a median home in Mesa.
Two of the ballot measures are city questions, and the other is a county one.
The feeling is that if there's more than one thing on the ballot, the most popular thing may not be impacted, but the rest of them might.
Mike O'Neill is a political analyst.
Schools usually rank number one. There's a lot of people with kids in the schools, and a lot of people who don't have kids in the schools who want to have good education.
In Mesa, every school override since 1995 has passed. Babette Sylvester is with the school district. She says there are consequences to staff if the $31.8 million override doesn't pass.
Currently, we pay for 136 teachers directly in the classroom that helps us keep our classroom sizes at a tolerable level. If we had to eliminate 136 teaching positions, that's equivalent to three elementary schools worth of teachers.
To save those and other positions, homeowners and businesses could see the school portion of their annual property tax bill go up 10%. A business worth $1 million would pay an additional $44 next year if the override passes, and a homeowner would pay an additional $8.
But if you say no, your taxes go down. That's the unspoken part of it.
O'Neill is right. The school district portion of your property tax would be reduced by a third. The other city question is the utility bond. Mesa operates its own utilities. City manager Christopher Brady says if the bond passes, he estimates a 7% increase in water rates, but that could change.
So the impact to the average resident will be determined not just on the overall cost of the projects, but as the number of people who continue to move into Mesa will allow us to spread that cost out over several accounts, which will help to minimize the rate increases necessary in the future.
The city is asking for this money to build a new water treatment plant to accommodate population growth. That would add about $120 annually to the average homeowner's utility bill. On top of those two potential increases, there is a countywide proposition that includes building a new hospital. Political analyst Mike O'Neill says the less local an issue is from voters, the less likely they are to support it.
People think of the county hospital as indigent care, and those are other people other than the voters for the most part.
This would add $26 to the hospital district's portion of the property tax bill for the owner of a median home. If all three of these measures are approved, the owner of a median-priced $192,000 home in Mesa would pay more than $150 in additional utility bills and taxes next year. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News.
Still to come with Election Day next week, a look back at some of Arizona's political trailblazers.
We wanted to highlight important political trailblazers of Arizona, people who were the first.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Not much going on in Valley traffic this afternoon, but watch out for one accident. It could cause you some problems. It's the 202 eastbound at the 101. It's blocking the shoulder. Partly cloudy for tonight around the valley, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Partly cloudy again tomorrow. Very similar temperature to today. We should top out at 92. It's currently 91 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Phoenix, launching 12 additional clinical trials to provide new treatment options for cancer, including prostate, lung, and colorectal. CancerCenter.com, keywords clinical trials.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. On the show in 8 minutes, treating domestic violence victims for brain injuries.
And later, Arizona's political pioneers.
But first, this is not a joke. And last spring, John Oliver, host of HBO's Last Week Tonight, told his viewers this is no drill. It's time to let the FCC know about net neutrality. The FCC.
The FCC are literally inviting internet comments at this address. And at this point, and I can't believe I'm about to do this, I would like to address the internet commenters out there directly. Good evening, monsters. This may be the moment you've spent your whole lives training for.
Lots of laughter there, but with Oliver's help, 3.7 million comments came into the FCC on the issue of net neutrality, calling for treating all internet traffic the same, no matter whether the customer is a giant media corporation or just a tiny little website. Internet service providers want to charge companies like Netflix and Hulu for the amount of bandwidth it takes to deliver their content. But last January, a federal appeals court struck down FCC rules that would have stopped them from playing favorites. Now the FCC is currently considering a proposal that would allow internet providers to charge content companies like Netflix to get their content to you faster. If someone can pay to get things faster online, then others are stuck with getting it slower or not at all. Michael Copps is a former FCC commissioner and a senior advisor for media and democracy reform at Common Cause, a liberal nonprofit advocacy group. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Does the apparent interest on the part of Americans commenting on the net neutrality issue in the FCC comment period give you hope that maybe their voices will be heard?
It gives me hope. I always realize, though, that we're up against very steep odds. Lots of money, lots of lobbyists, lots of lawyers on the other side. The power of the special interests in Washington is probably unparalleled since the Gilded Age of the 1880s and the 1890s. But I think when you get a real grassroots movement going, that can trump the power of the special interests. Doesn't happen very often, but that's where real reform comes from. And when we're talking about the future of the open internet, I think we're talking about the need for real reform to make sure that it does not become the playground of the few at the expense of the opportunity and well-being of the many.
The bad thing here, it seems to me, is the deregulation that took place in the 90s. If communications and the building of the broadband internet system had been more of a regulated system where the federal government was involved sort of in the same way it got involved late in the railroad game and early in the telephone game, we'd have less of an argument for private control because the private companies think that this infrastructure belongs to them.
Well, you'd have that, and you'd have a much more robust infrastructure to begin with. I think what these companies are doing now is rationing scarcity. It works fine for them. They're making big profits by rationing scarcity. We needed a national mission in this country, not just the late 1990s, but more recently in the last 15 years, too, to build this infrastructure. You cannot be a successful, productive member of society in the 21st century unless you have access to robust, high-speed, high-value, low-cost broadband with an open internet accompanying it.
Did the Clinton administration and the Senate under the Clinton administration make a mistake by not supporting that kind of federal investment to create a broadband infrastructure?
I think every administration has made a mistake doing that. I think the Clinton administration, certainly the Bush administration, they were ideologically opposed to it, plus the pressure of the special interests. But I think President Obama had an opportunity, and let's give him credit, he did more, at least they came with some broadband investment. But we needed much more than that kind of broadband investment. We were running the risk of not just the risk, but the reality of real digital gaps in the United States of America. We've got over 30 million households in this country that don't have any broadband connection, fixed or mobile.
Can the federal government fix those gaps and declare the existing infrastructure a common carrier and regulate its access and its bandwidth?
Right. But I don't want to fall into this trap of this is all about regulation. This is about seeing who is going to be in control of the consumer or the citizen's online experience. Is it going to be to the maximum extent possible that citizen and consumer, or is it going to be an ISP, a Comcast, an AT&T, or a Verizon? And that's the way we need to work at that. We should clear all of that underbrush away. This is simply about, is the FCC going to call advanced telecommunications, which is logical, which it should do, and treat it as such and have some light-touch public oversight of it? Make the assertion, reestablish the authority, then we can work with internet service providers and the public interest groups and consumers and fashion the rules.
When Verizon says this is our fiber optic infrastructure, are they a special interest in this particular case?
Of course they're a special interest, and they're a special interest that is aspiring right now to be not only a monopoly, but they want to be a totally unregulated monopoly. And I had thought, I used to be a historian, that we had kind of settled those debates at the beginning of the 20th century, and we weren't going to let these huge companies go without public interest oversight.
Would you support a federal tax incentive system or some set of incentives for these companies to reduce the scarcity, to increase the infrastructure, to increase the bandwidth that would incorporate all of the users equally?
I think they've got plenty of incentives right now. What held us back for a long time was just this ridiculous ideology of the Bush administration that the market was going to solve all of these problems. and go and build broadband, even in areas where there was no business case to build broadband. But this is going to be investment on a much larger basis, and I understand that's difficult to do that, but you have to look at this as an investment in the future of our country.
When you visited the meetings, if this comes down on the side of the corporations, do you think the pitchforks come out? People take to the streets on this? Is this a real revolution brewing?
Well, it ought to be. We'll see. I mean, you have to have a media that covers it. You guys in public radio do the best job of that. I think media is starting to cover this because they see this grassroots starting to develop. It's hard to develop that kind of a grassroots movement. We're trying. 4 million people have contacted the FCC. I think that's a good beginning. And God knows we need reform in this country, and there's no place where we need it more in making sure that we have a communications infrastructure that serves the needs of the people, gets them the news and the information they need in order to make intelligent decisions for the future and practice the practical arts of self-government.
Michael Copps is former FCC commissioner and a senior advisor for media and democracy reform at Common Cause, a liberal nonprofit advocacy group. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
More than 230 domestic violence victims have gotten treatment for traumatic brain injuries through a program at the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. The program has been around for about 2.5 years, but officials are just starting to talk publicly about it now. Dr. Javier Cardenas, the center's director, says the program sees about 20 to 30 men, women, and children a month. He says Valley shelters screen people for brain injury. If they test positive, they're sent to the clinic where they're evaluated for physical, cognitive, and behavioral health needs. Cardenas, though, says there are a lot more people who need this kind of treatment who aren't getting it.
It is simply the tip of the iceberg. I wish that we could say we're making a big dent in this particular issue, but we're not. There are too many people who have suffered from traumatic brain injury as a result of domestic violence. It was obviously highlighted in the last few weeks. Prominently and nationally. This is going on all the time.
So is there more that an organization like yours can do, or are you basically doing what you can do and others need to sort of step in and fill in the gaps?
What we hope to do is to demonstrate that our program can be duplicated at a national scale. We feel that we have the right model for this particular issue, but that it can be modified, it can be made better.
Is this the only program of its kind in the country or that you know of?
This is the only program in the country that I'm aware of. Now, as I mentioned, we've been doing this for over 2.5 years, and we've kept it pretty quiet. And the reason we've kept it quiet is because it is a very sensitive issue. We're also very cognizant of our partner organizations and the respect we have from them in really keeping the identities of their clients very secretive and making sure that we continue to provide the protection that they need.
Have you found any resistance from any of the patients that you've seen? I mean, there's still seems like there's kind of a stigma associated with being a victim of domestic violence. Have you seen patients who are not interested in the kind of treatment that you're offering?
Once they come to the clinic, now, to be honest, this is a very challenging population. And the reason it's a challenging population is indeed now these individuals who've left their domestic violence partner, left their abuser, are now in a situation in which they have no residence, they have no home. And so when they are able to come to us, and some of them don't show, but when they come to us, then they are very receptive to the care we provide because it is treating things like headaches and migraines, it's treating sleep disturbances, it's treating depression, treating anxiety. And so these are the things that we're able to provide to every client that comes through.
What are some of the differences you found in working with the folks that you had been working with prior, mostly athletes and other folks in other walks of life who have had traumatic brain injuries versus this population?
The challenges include the things that we call comorbidities or things that often accompany homelessness and domestic violence. Those would be things like psychiatric illness, mental health issues, including depression, including anxiety. Those things are far greater than the general population that we see who suffer from traumatic brain injuries, from sports-related injuries or motor vehicle crashes. Additionally, there are higher rates of things like drug abuse and alcohol abuse. In addition, poverty, of course. And so these other factors are all areas that we try to address.
Is there a research component to this program?
Absolutely. When it comes to research, if you look at the current literature, the incidence of traumatic brain injury in domestic violence victims ranges from 35% to 92%. Any scientist will tell you that those numbers stink. And the reason that they stink is because they're incredibly broad and they're incredibly inaccurate. One component of the program is indeed we are looking at the incidence of brain injury in domestic violence victims. With our partner organizations, we are looking to see who screens positive, number one, and then beyond that, when they come into the clinic, is there evidence that what they suffered in the past has a definite relationship to what they're experiencing now? Additionally, where there's another research component to check to see if our interventions are effective.
Dr. Javier Cardenas is the director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute.
Still ahead, preparing not for doomsday, but for every day.
The government wants us to become dependent on them. If you are self-sufficient, you are independent, and you don't need them to take care of you.
Preppers get prepped. It's the show.
It'll be partly cloudy across the valley tonight. Look for overnight lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow looks a lot like today, partly sunny with a high of 92. It's 91 degrees at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by Xavier College Prep, a Roman Catholic high school for young women, hosting an open house Sunday, November 2nd from noon to 2:30 with student-led campus tours and access to faculty and coaches. Info at xcp.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, says the Pentagon is being cautious in ordering 21 days of supervised isolation for all U.S. troops returning from Ebola response missions in West Africa. Dempsey says while military personnel will not have contact with Ebola patients, they will be in the affected countries longer than civilian healthcare workers.
They may go for, 30 or 60 days and then leave the area because of the intense pressure they're under. We're going to have our young men and women there for 6 months at a time. That's the duration of our deployment.
The total number of U.S. troops taking part in Ebola response efforts may grow to nearly 4,000 under current plans. The crash of a twin-engine prop plane has killed at least four people, including the pilot, and injured five others in Wichita, Kansas. Four people are still missing. Brad Crisp is a fire marshal with the Wichita Fire Department. He says the plane slammed into a building that housed four flight simulators.
We've been able to effectively search three of the four simulator rooms. We're unable to get into one of those. That accounts for about 5% of the building.
Crisp says the National Transportation Safety Board is sending investigators to the airport. National Guard troops have been deployed to a rural town on the Big Island of Hawaii as molten lava inches closer to a major roadway there and a number of homes. Hawaii Public Radio's Molly Solomon says between 16 and 30 homes may be in jeopardy.
I would say that the people that need to leave have left, but the civil defense is allowing residents to stay in their homes if they'd like. Most of those homes that are in the direct path have been cleared of belongings. They packed up their stuff. They've moved those things. But they are allowed to come back on their property so that they can witness what destruction does happen to their homes.
Solomon says the lava is moving at a pace of about 5 yards per hour. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 221. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody.
Arizona's last three governors, Jane Hull, Janet Napolitano, and Jan Brewer, have been female. But according to a new report, the state is not doing better than many other states in electing non-white men. The National Representation Index did a state-by-state analysis of more than 42,000 elected officials from the county level up and put Arizona in 41st place out of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Brenda Carter is with the Women Donors Network, which released the study.
In Arizona, according to our calculations, white men have almost six times as much political power as everybody else in the population, even when the percentage of the population is accounted for. So Arizona is looking like there's a lot of room for improvement.
And considering it's 41st out of 51, that doesn't necessarily mean the 40 states ahead of Arizona were doing well, right?
Right. That's the thing about this index, is that even if you're near the top, it's not as though it's a perfect reflection of the population in terms of the political leadership in those states. So really, pretty much every state in the country has a lot of room for improvement.
One of the things that intrigued me about the report is whether you were able to look at how many candidates of a certain background had even run for office without actually winning. And were there situations where people of color had decided to run for office, but they were running against some entrenched incumbent and they lost by 30 points, but they decided to run? Because I think what many of us would think, well, in order to start winning, more candidates of different backgrounds have to start running. Is that an issue at all as far as getting more candidates to run?
We did not look at that in this study, although that is something very worth looking at. Part of the focus of our project in subsequent phases after this initial research is to look at the ways that the political system actually throws up barriers to women and people of color. And the research and experience really points to a problem in women and people of color getting onto the ballot in the first place. There, of course, may be work to do in terms of how well women and people of color fare once they're on the ballot, but the research really points more to an earlier problem, which is that they're not making it onto the ballot in the first place, which we really think has a lot to do with the gatekeeper networks of political parties and other political organizations that make decisions about who's going to run for open seats or who's going to, receive resources and money in a campaign. Mm. And we think that that's one of the key places where women and people of color are being left out.
Brenda Carter of the Women Donors Network, which released the National Representation Index. In 1998, Arizona voters elected women to the top five statewide offices, from governor down to treasurer. Lisa Keegan was elected superintendent of public instruction. She says she never ran into clear obstacles to her candidacy.
I decided to run, and I can't remember anybody ever saying to me, you shouldn't do that because you're a woman. What resonates with me is sort of Margaret Thatcher's, I never noticed that there weren't a lot of women around. Because in Arizona, there were, at least when I was a young legislator.
There wasn't any feeling that because you were running in the conservative party, it just didn't matter because you were a good candidate?
I think that's it. I remember Janet Napolitano saying when all five of us got elected that this wasn't about women running for office. This was about qualified people running and winning. And at that time, four Republicans, one Democrat. And I think people misunderstand Arizona if they think what we are is primarily conservative. We're primarily libertarian, primarily independent. Primarily, we don't want other people telling us what to do. The biggest shock about being all women in an executive office in Arizona wasn't in Arizona. It took Arizona weeks to figure that out. It was on the East Coast. I remember all the media coming out and going, oh my gosh, did you have any idea this could happen? And no, there had been no stories about the fact that it could happen. It just did happen. And that to me was quintessential Arizona. It didn't matter. Our last governors have been named Jane, Janet, and Jan.
Do you think there should be more of an effort by somebody to encourage more females to run, more people of color to run, regardless of whether they're successful or not, just to decide, hey, be part of the process?
Yes. So, and I take that very personally, and I do it personally. And I will say I'm unabashed about it. I go to young women first. So I think it's critically important to have a lot of women in the process. And I, even though, growing up in Arizona and growing up politically in Arizona, women have had a much more of a presence. We still aren't on par, right? We've been governor a lot, so it's hard to complain, but we don't have the same distribution. And young women don't ordinarily see themselves as readily in these roles as young men do. And even I do speak to young men about this as well. They're much more likely to think they're qualified.
Former Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Lisa Keegan.
Now,
As voters are set to return politicians to office or elect new ones next week, an exhibit at ASU looks at some of Arizona's political firsts. The show is called Political Trailblazers on Campaign and includes memorabilia from politicos like Alfredo Gutierrez, Ed Pastor, and Peterson Zah. The exhibit comes from the collections of the Labriola National American Indian Data Center and the Chicano Research Collection, each at ASU. I met up with the group's respective curators, Joyce Martin and Nancy Godoy.
We wanted to highlight important political trailblazers of Arizona, people who were the first.
Joyce, what do you hope that people who come to see this will learn from it, will take away from it?
Well, I hope they can see, first of all, the some of the amazing collections that we have here at ASU Libraries. And I hope that they're able to learn about the wide variety of political candidates that we do have here in Arizona. So trying to highlight politics in a broader way.
What do you think it says about Arizona that for a lot of these trailblazers, a lot of these firsts, a lot of them are around still? Some of them are still even in politics now.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really exciting things about Arizona. And one of the things that Nancy and I noticed as we started to pull together this list of firsts is that a lot of the firsts happened very recently. So for whatever that says about Arizona, you know, the first Mexican-American congressman, 1991, we started looking at, of course, when American Indians received the right to vote here in Arizona wasn't until 1948. So a lot of these events really are current events. It's things that people really need to understand politics today.
So this exhibit is a little bit unique in the sense that it's not all in one just big open space or in a couple of adjoining rooms. It's on three separate floors of Hayden Library at ASU. Do you see that as a challenge? Do you see that as an opportunity? Is that just purely logistics in the sense of how this was set up?
Well, I actually see it as a huge opportunity, a way to get people to really look at the library as a whole. So there's something in the rotunda, right, where people walk in the library to draw people into the exhibit. And then we direct people up to the two collections, special collections that are focused within this exhibit.
In looking at the folks that you've highlighted in this exhibit, the one thing that kind of sticks out is they're all Democrats. They're all sort of left of center. Was there any thought or attempt to put firsts of people who are either more conservative, Republicans, people to the right of center?
If we had the collections, we would have highlighted them. Unfortunately, we don't have any collections that focus on Republican or more conservative political figures. That's actually something we would like to go out into the community and collect, because we want to tell every side of or everyone's story.
Does it take away from the exhibit at all? Do you think that you don't have those kinds of things right now?
I guess my first reaction was, no, I don't think it's limiting for this particular exhibit, because the focus of this exhibit really is political trailblazers. And so, again, I think this exhibit represents our holdings, but it represents a very small focus of our political collections. So there are within other special collections in the libraries, like the Arizona collection. We do have, for example, the John McCain papers. So we do have a wide variety of people that are represented within our collections. But this exhibit was a narrow focus, a collaboration between Nancy and I and our specific collections.
When you go through the exhibit, what do you see?
For me, it's really exciting to see some of the great material that we have, that we get to work with every day. To see it out on display for the public is really exciting for us. It's exciting to see some of those connections that we have with amazing political figures, how they're connected to ASU.
Nancy, when you go through the exhibit, what do you see?
I see hope for future Latino politicians, so the next generation of change makers.
Nancy Godoy is curator of the Chicano Research Collection at ASU. I also spoke with Joyce Martin, curator of the Labriola National American Indian Data Center. The exhibit, Political Trailblazers on Campaign, will be up until January.
As U.S. cable news networks squeal about the latest so-called news headline, in France, a small independent television news channel has become one of the country's most influential forces in media and politics.
BFM TV pioneered the live rolling news format in France. Its direct, in-your-face brand of journalism for the people has won it a daily audience of millions and plenty of critics who say it's sensationalist and trivializes politics.
Unlike other mainstream channels, it's also unashamedly pro-business. So does it reflect changing views in France about the changing role of the government and the power of private enterprise to rescue the country's ailing economy? The BBC's Hugh Schofield has been finding out.
Pour vous faire vivre tous les événements en direct, BFM TV est là.
BFM claims to be the most popular rolling news station in the world. Its market share in France way above Sky in Britain or Fox in the US. And it's true, at airports and hotels, in chic Paris cafes, but also in banlieue kebaberies, in political party headquarters, BFM is the channel of choice. It's live, it's quick, it's intelligent. The station's managing director is Guillaume Dubois.
Everybody watches BFM TV from the Élysée Palace to the street. Not all day long, hopefully for them. but we have more than 10 million viewers per day and 40 million per month, so it's more or less all of France.
Et attention, les voici, le coup.
A huge part of BFM's attraction for the French is that it very deliberately tries not to ape the established channels. French journalism has long and rightly been accused of being in cahoots with the elite, journalists, politicians and administrators all discussing the world at one remove from ordinary people. That's not the BFM way, as I heard from 34-year-old Apolline de Malherbe, who presents a political talk show.
I think for too long in France we have had elites who have contempt for the people, and I think that was wrong, and I think that's also part of the reason why somebody like Marine Le Pen has such a high score today, because the people who vote for her had the feeling for too long that they had no power, they were not even taken into account by the politicians, by the journalists, by the media, by the elites.
Notre invité ce matin, Marine Le Pen, présidente du Front National, bonjour.
There are criticisms. One is that with its people-first approach, it gives undue coverage to the far right. Star interviewer Jean-Jacques Bourdin recently got into a public row with a well-known satirist who accused him of actually promoting Marine Le Pen.
Nicolas Doz et les experts sur BFM Business.
But I think what left-wing critics have missed is actually something far more important. This is the clear pro-business ethic behind BFM TV. In fact, the station started out as a business channel. The B stands for business, and its economic commentators take an overtly pro-reform line on downsizing the state, supporting business creation, and so on. This is actually quite new for the French, who've been mainly given an economic diet of the old state-orientated nostrums. So does the popularity of BFM with this underlying message reflect perhaps a younger generation's understanding of economic realities? A question for Jean-Sébastien Ferjou of the right-wing news website Atlantico.
Yes, as I said before, I think the country is changing, not because French people have become liberals in the French meaning of the term, but because they no longer believe in the state. They no longer do. They no longer feel that the state is going to save them. We've been in such a crisis for now more than 6 years, and with a political power which seems totally powerless, and so people just, I mean, it's just common sense. Why should you expect that the state is going to save you?
It's just a television station, but the rise of BFM TV does say something about France today. A contempt for the ruling elite and a thirst for practical solutions to the country's deepening crisis.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield reporting. Looking for partly cloudy skies tonight around the valley, overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. Currently it's partly cloudy and 91 degrees. It's the show at 2:52.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera, performing Rigoletto. Bad things happen when you hire an assassin in a dive bar. November 14th through 16th in Symphony Hall. More info at azopera.org.
How energy efficient is Arizona? According to a new scorecard, not bad. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy's 8th annual report ranks Arizona 15th. Massachusetts and California took the top two spots. Jeff Schlegel, the Arizona representative for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project, says the scorecard looked at six areas, including utility programs, transportation, and building energy codes.
Arizona ranked particularly well in utility programs and in the programs and policies that utilities like Arizona Public Service and SRP offer to their customers. And in particular, Arizona ranked very high in actual savings for customers. In that key area of actual electricity savings for utility customers, Arizona ranked fourth overall, which was the best outside of the New England states. In that area, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's the bottom line for SWEEP, actual savings for customers. And we were very pleased to see that Arizona ranked fourth nationally.
Where does Arizona struggle?
You know, a ranking of 15th isn't really a struggle compared to, say, other national rankings that Arizona is often compared in. There are areas for improvement, I would say. You know, Arizona in the other five categories is more or less in the middle of the pack. It excels in the utility program area, and it's in the middle of the pack in the other five. So, for example, building energy codes. We've got some communities and towns, municipalities that have adopted great building energy codes, but we have other towns that either have no energy code or a less ambitious energy code. So that's one area where some municipalities could adopt better energy codes.
So Arizona dropped three spots in this latest report. Is that a symptom of Arizona not doing as well as it could, or other states just sort of doing better and making more improvement than Arizona was making?
It's a combination of the two. Arizona could certainly do better in some of these areas. Again, transportation, building codes, appliance standards. It's in the middle of the pack there. But the primary reason is that, you know, many states are doing more energy efficiency. So states can jump ahead of others. In addition, ACEEE raised the bar in some categories. Now that states are doing better, the scale moves up, and that acknowledges the ongoing improvements in many states. So if you're doing what you did last year, you're going to lose points and move down in the rankings.
When you look at numbers like that, what are the practical impacts? I mean, other than being proud that Arizona is, you know, in the top half of the states across the country, are there other practical benefits that the state gets from something like this?
Yes, the best practical benefit is really the energy savings, which means utility bill reductions for customers, much lower utility costs, much lower utility bills. Then customers spend those energy savings in their local economy, and they, you know, create jobs and provide additional economic benefits and economic development locally. In addition, there are the environmental benefits. You know, not using energy or using less energy provides some significant environmental benefits, including increased air quality and less water use. So these are all direct benefits that customers get from energy efficiency. The scorecard itself is simply that. It's simply a ranking. And if you're higher on the scorecard, your customers are getting more of those benefits. If you're lower on the scorecard, they're getting fewer benefits.
Jeff Schlegel is the Arizona representative for the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project.
You can see the scorecard at kjzz.org.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
You may have heard about the search for the best burrito in the country that was conducted by statistician Nate Silver's blog 538.
That search got us thinking about the best burrito in the valley. So we're on the hunt, leaving no burrito unfolded or unbitten, but we need your help.
Tell us your favorite burrito in town by emailing us at theshow@kjzz.org. It just might end up with the coveted title, official winner of the KJZZ Best Burrito Bonanza 2014.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
Being prepared for a large-scale disaster is not a new notion. In the days of the Cold War, many Americans built bomb shelters stocked with food to protect their families from potential nuclear fallout. While the threat of nuclear war may have diminished, the prepper culture remains. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the Arizona Prepper Fest held this weekend in Scottsdale was a showcase for a new kind of prepper mentality.
Our tagline is, it's not for doomsday, it's for every day.
That's Tony Tangelos, promoter of the Arizona Prepper Fest. He says while television and popular culture have come to portray preppers as conspiracy theorists waiting for the sky to fall, the movement is actually much more down to earth.
For us, it's not about the end of the world, it's not about the Skittles hitting the fan, it's about just living a self-reliant, agrarian, healthy living lifestyle.
That's not to say you couldn't find vendors with supplies for those who are worried about the apocalypse. There were plenty of booths selling things like emergency medical supplies,
Israeli pressure bandages, we have hemostatic agents like QuikClot, Celox, all the suturing sets that people need,
military-grade body armor.
That's level 3 rated. It's up to 6 pounds of 308.
And yes, even freeze-dried food to stock your bunker.
We have pasta primavera and chicken teriyaki with rice and then chili mac with beef.
There were also a few groups in attendance with a decidedly greater sense of urgency.
I personally feel we're headed for a civil war between the United States federal government and the state governments.
Ernie Engel is with the Arizona Rifles Tactical Survivalists. He was recruiting members for his group, which will leave the city and go to remote sites around Phoenix when he says things inevitably go south.
You see the ISIS situation, you see the Ebola situation in the valley. You have multiple prisons. What do you think is going to happen when those prisoners are released because there's nobody there to keep them in?
But not everyone in attendance was focusing so much on fear. In fact, a majority of the booths and programs centered on green living and home energy conservation. Peter Bigfoot is a prepper who takes pride in his self-reliance. He says retailers used to laugh at him when he went to purchase shoes for his larger-than-average feet.
And I said, well, if you can make shoes, I can make shoes. And I just kind of went out in the desert and sat on a rock till I figured it out and made myself a pair of shoes. And they fit, and they were comfortable.
He still makes his own shoes, practices herbal medicine, and organic gardening on his farm. Skills like these, not a sense of inherent danger, are what Amber Jones brought her family to the festival to learn. She's concerned about exposing her young children to genetically modified foods.
There's great ways to do gardening where the water can actually be recycled and filtered, so you're actually learning about conservation as well as growing your own fruits and veggies.
It's this kind of self-reliant lifestyle that Peter Bigfoot says modern preppers should embrace.
Makes it possible for me to have a lot of freedom and a lot less fear in life. The thing is to make the best of it where you are.
He says he's prepared because he lives his life healthy and happy. He'll let the sky fall where it may. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Be sure to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show Friday edition. Maricopa County has been dealing with more cases of West Nile virus this year, and our series We Are the Valley heads to the skate park. That and much, much, much more coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
Today's show is produced by senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. The managing editor, Al Macias, executive producer, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have a good story idea. You can send us a note at theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.